you're an adult with asthma, do you really have it?
And if you're a kid, do you benefit from tonsillectomy?
What can the increased incidence of type 2 diabetes in China teach us?
And when is a calcium cardiac score helpful?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on January 20th, 2017. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we turn first? There's really a bunch of information coming out about hypertension management, but for today, we're going to talk about a study that was published in Circulation, taking a look at how we can inform management of people who are sort of not in either risk category that's very high or very low.
I queued this up a little bit differently, Elizabeth. When is a calcium score beneficial? Because as you allude, there are people that have mildly elevated blood pressure, and lowering it further can lower their cardiovascular risk. There are other people who have mildly elevated blood pressure, and doing so may not be helpful. Lowering their blood pressure further increases their risk of side effects, but doesn't really lower their cardiovascular risk. These investigators, many of them from Hopkins, looked at what was called the MESA study, the multi-ethnic study of atherosclerosis. This is thousands of individuals followed for a decade. Those individuals had a routine assessment of their risk of having some type of cardiac event over the next 10 years. And they did it with traditional risk factors. And then those individuals also had a coronary calcium score. They did a scan to see how much calcium was in the arteries in their heart. And here's what they discovered. If you were already considered to be at high risk, that is, you had a more than 15% risk of having some cardiovascular event based upon routine risk factors, doing a calcium score didn't really help. Likewise, if your risk was less than 5%, it wasn't helpful. But in that range of 5 to 15%, the presence of calcium in your coronary arteries identified individuals in whom we should give more intensive blood pressure lowering therapy.
Well, so this is really very provocative. I would sure like to see the heart outcomes assessed in this, not just a calculation.
Well, the heart outcomes, this is an observational study, and your point's well taken. You'd like to do this in a prospective way. So I agree with you on that.
Well, we're going to be talking more about hypertension, so I'll just foreshadow that. Let's turn from here then to JAMA. Something I served up as well, if you're an adult with asthma, do you really have it?
You know, I thought this was really a fascinating study. We know probably more about childhood asthma than we do adult onset asthma. If you're a child and you develop asthma, 3/4 of those children subsequently seem to outgrow it. But many individuals get asthma when they're an adult. If that happens, is it a lifelong condition or does it also go away? So these investigators conducted a study at 10 different Canadian cities where they called several thousand individuals to identify those that had asthma diagnosed within the last 5 years. They identified over 600 who had asthma. They said, okay, well, great. Well, you were diagnosed with it. Do you still have it? So they did routine breathing tests. Or they gave them a challenge. They gave them something that would normally constrict the airways in people that had asthma. And if they had no evidence of asthma, then they decreased their asthma medications by 50% and did it again. And if there still was no asthma, they stopped the medications altogether and did it again several weeks later. And in doing that, they discovered that 1/3 of the individuals who were said to have asthma had no evidence of it at all. When they stopped their medications and followed them for a year, 90% of them had no evidence of asthma at all. So this suggests one of two things. Either in about 1/3 of adults with asthma, it either goes away, or conversely, some of these individuals who were thought to have asthma and treated as such really didn't have it from the very beginning.
To me, because asthma can be such an onerous diagnosis, and I think probably has some factors involved with it that people perseverate on and worry about, it says if you've got a new diagnosis of asthma, maybe it's prudent to test again in 6 months or a year and see if you still have it.
Well, I'd take it a step further, Elizabeth. If you're diagnosed with asthma, many times they don't undergo the routine testing to confirm it right up front. And because, as you suggest, these are conditions that are treated for months and years with medications, you want to be sure that's exactly what the problem is. Pulmonary societies recommend that if you're diagnosed with it, it actually requires an initial test to prove it. And then, as you said, if it looks on medication like your asthma is controlled or has gone away, they can retest to see whether we can stop the medications altogether. That minimizes the risk and minimizes the cost of the medications.
I think this is great news with regard to asthma because if it helps people to say, okay, I don't need these medications, I think that that's a great thing.
I agree. Again, it reduces the side effects and reduces the cost and sometimes aggravation of taking chronic medications if you don't need them.
talking about chronic medications and staying in the Journal of the American Medical Association, I asked, hey, what can this increase in type 2 diabetes in China teach us?
You know, if you went back to the 1980s, the prevalence of diabetes in China was actually fairly low. It's estimated to be only about 1%. Well, what we see in the United States is actually mirrored in China. Where do you want to start with, Elizabeth?
Well, I think that this study, at least to me, points to all the traditional risk factors that are relative to the development of type 2 diabetes, and in my mind really proves that this is a modifiable condition. Sorry to package it already like that, but that's my conclusion.
Well, I would agree. What's happened is the prevalence, which was less than 1% just a couple decades ago, now hovers closer to about 6 or 7%. It's 8% in urban areas and 4% in rural areas. There's an increased risk of cardiovascular disease, specifically stroke and death, and other things associated with diabetes, an increase in chronic liver disease, infections, and cancers of the liver, pancreas, breast, and reproductive systems. So all of this has happened over the last decade as a result of the urbanization and westernization of China.
Right. This big change in diet, increase in sedentary lifestyle, change in obesity. As I suggested, this is a huge public health kind of an experiment in my mind. I think this also points to the fact that, gosh, we really need some effective interventions.
Intervention to prevent diabetes, and let's put it in some numbers where people can understand it. If you're diagnosed at the age of 50 and you're Chinese, it shortens your lifespan by about 9 years. The other thing they discovered in China is not only is the prevalence going up, but the quality of therapy is not very good. Very few people are well controlled, and in terms of other associated medications to lower the risk of heart disease aren't being used as widespread as they should be. So this is not just about diabetes, but all the associated diseases that come with it.
Okay, finally then, let us turn to pediatrics. A pretty comprehensive look at the benefits or lack thereof of tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy.
This group actually looked at the use of tonsillectomy as a component of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality commissioned comparative effectiveness review. What they're trying to do is for time-honored things that we've used to say, gosh, are they really effective? They did a meta-analysis of all the studies looking at tonsillectomy for two different conditions, tonsillitis, and these are kids. The second condition was for kids that have obstructive sleep apnea. Is a tonsillectomy very effective? So which of those two conditions do you want to talk about first, Elizabeth?
I really am agnostic on this. I'll let you pick.
Okay, so let's talk first about obstructive sleep apnea. This is oftentimes because kids have really enlargement of their tonsils or adenoids. In those individuals, does doing a tonsillectomy help? And does it make their breathing any better? Because kids that have obstructive sleep apnea really have an increased incidence of behavioral problems and learning difficulties. And the studies suggest that relative to just watchful waiting, kids that have tonsillectomy have a better outcome. They're less likely to be bothered by sleep apnea, and they have an improved quality of life, fewer negative behaviors like anxiety and emotional lability. The length of the follow-up was relatively short. It was less than a year, but it looked like it was beneficial. The next thing was, what about kids that have recurring tonsillitis? Well, in those kids, the tonsillectomy did seem to improve their outcome for a short period of time, their outcome being how many recurrent episodes of tonsillitis did they have, or how many days of school did they miss, but it didn't change the quality of life. Longer term, there was no difference between kids that had their tonsils out and kids that did not.
And so I would have to say in summation, I'm not necessarily finding this terribly helpful with regard to decision making, because I think that it's sort of, if you have a kid who's got recurrent infections, maybe it's going to help in the short term. What about the risks of the procedure itself?
Well, the risks are fairly minimal. It's very unusual for a child to have a complication. It was in these studies, by the way. I think your point's well taken. For infection, well, maybe a little bit of a short-term benefit, but if you just wait it out, the kids usually outgrow the tonsillitis, and there's really no proven benefit. I think the data is a little bit more convincing for the obstructive sleep apnea, however.
I guess the other piece of data that I would like to see with regard to the obstructive sleep apnea is the weight of these kids, the BMI.
You know, that's an interesting thing. This particular study didn't mention it. We know that there are some conditions associated with sleep apnea. You mentioned one, obesity, but in kids, oftentimes, it's developmental abnormalities and Down syndrome as well, and not necessarily the obesity that we see in adults.
Okay, so I'm just going to end by saying that there is some data relative to adverse complications following tonsillectomy and adenoidectomy that suggest it's not as benign as many of us assume because it's so common. So I guess that's the other caveat I would sort of wave out there.
And again, for those conditions and where there may be a short-term benefit but no long-term benefit, knowing that can help parents decide whether they want to proceed with that or not. So I'm glad you brought that up, Elizabeth.
On that note, I'm going to talk about the management of hypertension and those at intermediate risk this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.